Worried about letting someone else pick out the perfect avocado for your perfect impress them on the third date guacamole? Well, good thing Instacart shoppers are as picky as you are. They find ripe avocados like it's their guac on the line. They are milk expiration date detectives. They bag eggs like the 12 precious pieces of cargo they are. So let Instacart shoppers overthink your groceries so that you can overthink what you'll wear on that third date. Download the Instacart app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
Grant, Danny, 106.7 The Fan. Welcome back and thanks a ton for listening to the first half of our show. Pete Medhurst keeping us up to date every 30 minutes. Second half of the program going to star Dane Brugler, 12:45. He'll join us to talk NFL draft. And our buddy Chris Miles of NBA TV is going to stop by to break down the Wizards and the Raptors game three tonight. We also got to talk, as Pete just pointed out, Scherzer, Kershaw this evening.
That's a thing.
That is as good as it gets in baseball. And this will be boring for a lot of people, but I want to do it anyway. We got to debate which of those two guys is the best pitcher on the planet right now. So we can do that ahead of tonight's game. Let's kick off the Beltway Blitz. Caps got a massive Game 4 win. Series back even at two games apiece. Chris Russell's our Caps Insider is presented by Dominion Jewelers. Custom engagement rings and jewelry in the heart of Falls Church. They make it beautiful. You make it yours. DominionJewelers.com. Russell, how have the Caps pulled back even in the last two?
Just simple dominance. They shut down the neutral zone, contain the speed. Artemi Panarin keeps taking stupid penalties, which takes him off the ice and out of rhythm. Braden Holtby's been great. Tom Wilson's been phenomenal. The speed of Hughes and Verana and Chandler Stephenson have all been good. TJ Oshie was awesome last night. Ovechkin. I mean, you know, there's so many reasons. And a big one, correct me if I'm wrong, Grant, I think they're 7 of 7 killing penalties.
Yes.
In Columbus in games 3 and 4. And we know they were dreadful in Washington.
Russell, I feel like you need to start with the giving credit to the Capitals. They were sensational last night, as good a game as they've played in the playoffs or any other time for some time. They were awesome. The other side of the coin, though, is Columbus was, you know, doggy leftovers left out in the sun. It was bad, dude.
Right.
I don't expect Columbus to be that way come tomorrow at 3 p.m. for puck drop. What are your thoughts there on Columbus regrouping?
No, I'm right there with you. I am fearful of tomorrow. The Caps, you know, much like the Redskins, they don't handle prosperity well. They handle and they feed off of adversity, if you will, or, you know, where their feet are held to the fire. And I'm right there with you, Danny. I was thinking the same thing. I'll be there at 3 o'clock tomorrow. Nick and I are doing the show after the game tomorrow. I hope we're going to be celebrating the Capitals win, but they are going to have to work their ass off. They came out last night with a lot of jump, Washington. They're going to have to come out with that same kind of jump and keep that same intensity rolling through the third period, because you know John Tortorella is going to absolutely hammer his guys.
Yeah, is that a realistic concern for me? Is it just kind of the Caps fan deep inside of me? I am worried about a letdown. I feel like there's a feeling in the city like they've made this huge accomplishment when really they just got back to zero here. It's 2-2.
Yeah.
But last night I was kind of celebrating on my way home like the series was over. That's not healthy.
Well, I mean, listen, it's okay to celebrate, and it's okay to feel happy and positive about things. I don't think there's anything wrong with that. But, you know, you've got to flush it away. Like, there, you know, for instance, I'm sure Columbus is practicing today at their practice facility before flying to Washington, right? The Capitals are having an optional skate. I don't know about you guys. I know it's a tough turnaround, but with no game day skate tomorrow morning because of the time, I would have liked to have seen Barry maybe, you know, hold a little 3 p.m. practice or something like that just to get guys going, just to keep guys' heads in it. I don't want them to feel, again, too inflated. But that being said, it's hard to do that when you play probably your best game, certainly of the postseason. Guys, I don't know about you. It reminded me of that Sunday night Easter win in Pittsburgh, almost in terms of the start-to-finish kind of dominance, if you will, for the Capitals last night.
Russell, you're the best, man. Thank you for the time, as always.
Thank you, guys.
Let's talk Redskins, please, Tommy. Our guy, Craig Hoffman, covers the Redskins for 106.7. Then that's the station you're listening to right now. Hoff, the calendar was released, a.k.a. the schedule. Everybody got their pantaloons in a bunch and got really excited, then down, then excited again. I just think it's a calendar we should all settle down. Predicting when the loss is irresponsible. But what jumped out at you about this Redskins schedule this year, maybe as opposed to years past?
Let's be irresponsible, Danny. It's our favorite thing in the whole wide world. I think the early bye is meaningful, but maybe not as meaningful as last year. They have the bye as early as you can possibly have it in week four, and that's less than ideal. But unlike last year where they played on Thanksgiving, as they have now for three straight seasons, they at least don't have to play on the following Thursday as well. So last year you had that weird three games in 12 days bit. You don't get that this year. You get almost a second bye going from Thanksgiving to Monday Night Football between weeks 12 and 13. So the early bye, not as damaging potentially as it could be, but that's certainly, to me, the first thing that sticks out.
Craig, as far as the back half of the schedule goes, as you mentioned, no division games until week 7 and then a really difficult final stretch run. They're going to have to put some hay in the barn early, eh?
Yeah, for sure. And they're going to have to do it against a really good run of quarterbacks early. Those first 6 weeks of the season, they have three former number one overall picks, two future first ballot Hall of Famers, and a bye. That's their first 6 weeks of the season with Breeze and Andrew Luck and Cam Newton and, you know, Sam Bradford. You know, you go, oh, well, he'll never be healthy except for they get him week one. So even with Arizona, they're either going to get a first-round rookie who beat out Sam Bradford or they're going to get Sam Bradford in his first start with no idea of what to expect and no tape. So it's a really interesting schedule for sure. It's a tough schedule, I think, because that's the NFL, though. You know, I think at this time of the year, you're always looking through every team as a positive, you know, what's the best they could be, including your own. And, you know, when you look at some of the teams that they're going to have to face, even early, you go, all right, the Cardinals stunk last year, but they could be all right. If Luck's back, what do the Colts look like? And you got Aaron Rodgers in week three. So it's an interesting schedule where they've got to put, as you said, some hay in the barn early. They got to rack up some wins because the end of the schedule is going to be so consequential. But the beginning of the schedule is no delight either.
Craig, thank you, buddy. Always appreciate the time.
You got it. See you guys.
See you, man. There he goes. Got to finish that workout. Let's talk Wizards, please. The handsomest man I ever did see, Nick Ashew, standing to my left. I will not be taking any pictures. Nick knows Wizards. What do you think? Dead cat bounce tonight? Can they get back in the series? What are we talking about?
I want to give them one. I feel stupid giving them two wins in the series, though, with the way that they've played so far. The fact that they – look, we talked about this before it started, where Toronto was a much better three-point shooting team than they were in the past. I didn't expect them to be this good. 16 threes in game one, 13 in game two. Do you know, too, the Wizards gave up 11 threes in the first half to the Raptors in game two. They were outscored by 18 by halftime. When they actually defended the three, and the Raptors only hit two threes in the second half of game two, the Wizards actually outscored them in the second half by 7. So here's a novel idea. Defend the three-point shot. You might actually give yourself a shot in this in game three. Look, it's frustrating watching what's going on. I think the biggest thing for me, too, is that you heard the quiet whispers of this team saying, oh, they wanted Toronto. They knew they could handle Toronto. Well, guess what? Toronto's a better team than you this year. Toronto's a better team than they were in the playoffs when you played them before. And they're also knocking down threes left and right, and you're not defending them. You're too busy yelling at each other on the bench.
Brian Geltzeiler on Chad's show yesterday talked about John Wall being a big part of the problem and essentially said he should be shopped, thinks he will be this offseason, thinks that his teammates don't like him, there's not enough effort. Do you buy any of that?
So here's my thing. Last year, John Wall was considered an outside MVP candidate. People were debating whether he was the best point guard in the NBA. Everything was happy because the Wizards were winning. John Wall's missed a lot of time this year because he's been injured, and even when he was playing, he was also injured throughout a lot of this season. So whenever there's controversy, whenever a team's struggling, whenever things aren't moving the way that they're supposed to, this is the first thing you hear is somebody's a problem. Who's the problem? Let's find the star. And maybe there are players bickering with John Wall. We can tell that he and Gortat don't get along. We've known that for a while. This is nothing new. But the conversation always ends up being somebody doesn't get along with somebody, that guy needs to be shopped. John Wall's still one of the best point guards in the NBA. Yep. What are you going to get in return? If you're going to shop John Wall, you're basically rebuilding this team, so you better get a lot in return, and I doubt that they're going
to
get that.
To me, you have a constant here, as you've had turmoil, a bunch of different types, whether it's poo in the shoe, clown shoes, you know, everybody else, the guns in the locker room, whatever it's been. Mm-hmm. The one constant is the guy that's supposed to be setting the culture here. Yet another thing is festering, yet another tempest under Ernie Grunfeld's watch. At any point, can anything at some time be the eye directed towards him?
Look, this may be, if this team loses, let's say they lose in five games, This may be the offseason that Leonsis finally says, I need a new general manager here. And I know most people in this town don't like Ernie, and really everybody probably doesn't like the job that Ernie's done. But in a decade and a half, he has produced two different eras of playoff teams. But overall, there have also been a lot of mistakes. And at some point, you just need a new direction, a new vision with the team.
16 years,
and that may be what you have to do with Ernie. I don't want Scott Brooks to go. You got to give Scott Brooks more to work with. But there also, yes, there is a culture with this team that they don't know their resume. They think that they're better than they are, and they've had this notion all year that, oh, we can turn it on in the playoffs. You're not the Warriors. You're not what the Spurs have been in the past. You turn it on in the regular season, so you're not the eighth seed going into the playoffs getting stomped by the Raptors.
Nick, you may want to check your at replies. It's been a
just,
busy couple
this
minutes.
This is what, this is, I can't even look. This. I've just said, you guys with this bit, you're like a puppy with a chew toy, where once you sink your teeth into it,
sure,
there's no
bit.
Pulling it out, and it's not going away.
Sure, it's a bit that you're
it's
not
just
handsome.
A bit.
The
it's
bit
just
you'll
a
be
bit.
Living until the day you die, I'll tell you that right now. Bye, Nick Ashew.
Bye, Nick. Gentlemen.
That is your Beltway Blitz. We are Grant and Danny. Next, Alex Ovechkin delivers on a guarantee of sorts. We'll talk about the blame he deserves for the Capitals' lack of playoff successes over the years through the lens of this series. NFL draft next hour with Dane Brugler as well. And before the end of the show, plenty on the Wizards and the Raptors Game 3 on the Fan. Grant and Danny, 106.7 The Fan. Alex Ovechkin takes a lot of heat for the Capitals' lack of playoff success in his tenure. But if you look at the numbers in terms of points average per postseason game all time among active and really players and dating back to the beginning of the National Hockey League, he's one of the best ever in that capacity. He has now racked up 43 points in a little over 30 games the Capitals have played while trailing in a series. And with the Capitals down 2-0 after he scored 2 goals in a loss in Game 2, coming to Columbus, he said they were going to win Game 3 and they were going to win Game 4. And he went out and he tallied 4 points in the last 2 games, including the goal that really changed everything last night. They were up 2-0, third period. Ovechkin in the offensive end got a rare opportunity with the puck in front of Sergei Bobrovsky, and he put one in the back of the net.
Coming now is Wilson. Right side into the circle, a shot blocked and run down by Cole. Coming away, the shot, they score! Wilson gets it out to Ovechkin. It's a 5-on-5 goal for Alex Ovechkin with 17:11 to go. It's 3-0, Washington!
When they lose, he gets clubbed, and he is the head of the snake, so some of that is understandable.
Sure.
He wears the C, he's the best player. In football, it's the quarterback. In hockey, it's your number one guy, your Hart Trophy winner. He's done that 3 times as a league MVP. There are people that say you can't build your team with a wing. It's got to be a center, Sidney Crosby, somebody of that ilk. Games like last night, though, are why I will always take umbrage with the notion that the problem for the Capitals in the playoffs is Ovechkin, because when they face elimination generally, or they are down in the series, he does his best work. And this guy, 6 points in the last 3 games, has been a machine for this team.
He's been good, and I think he gets unfairly beat up the same way, as we talked about, that a quarterback would. The quarterback wins and losses in a team sport, and hockey even more so. When Alex Ovechkin is on fire, fully healthy, playing great, barely over a third of the game he plays. Barely over a third. I'm talking 22 minutes. That's kind of your peak Ovechkin. That's if there are a couple power plays there. Whereas a quarterback doesn't play on special teams, doesn't play defense. He's got a lot of control. He helps, certainly, and you can pick apart his play because he's going to be earning the most. He's going to be the leader, et cetera. But Ovechkin, it's somewhere in between. Doesn't deserve as much criticism, blame, whatever you want to call it, for them not getting past a certain point in his entire era. He deserves more blame than Curtis Glencross. Deserves more blame than, name that anonymous the fourth winger or third D-pairing guy. Because he's the linchpin, but probably deserves less than he gets. Doesn't deserve to be called a choking dog or kind of whatever else. The response I would have to you is, it is admirable that when they're down, he's been at his best. What about when they're up? What about when you've had a chance to put somebody away? And the anecdotal evidence, I'm not going to be able to produce the appropriate stats for game situation or what Sidney Crosby's Corsi score is when facing a potential to move on to the next round. I'm not going to be able to pull that stuff. I just know this. It seems that when one of the other guys that's a superstar needs to step on the throat, he does. when it's, hey, we're down. That's awesome. Ovechkin's done that. What about when you're up 3-1 and you have a chance to close out the Rangers?
Fair.
What about when you've got a chance?
I think you got to go back through all those games, though, and find
of course
how many goals, how many assists, how many points. What did he do? But I see a guy
anecdotal.
Who's back-checking, who's
right.
playing 200 feet of hockey. Here's what Tarik El-Bashir said to us. He, of course, covers the team for NBC Sports Washington in town when asked about Ovechkin in these last two games and the guarantee the Caps would come back even.
You know, the best thing about that guarantee, and I'm using air quotes, I know you guys can't see it on radio, is he just so casually just dropped it in a random morning skate conversation with reporters. You know, it wasn't like he was like, all right, listen up, everyone. We're going to, you know, it wasn't like some rah-rah, here's what we're going to do. It was just kind of casual, but he was very confident when he said it. I think he meant it. Just said, yeah, you know what, it's going to be a lot of fun when we go back to game to D.C. for game 5. After getting a couple of wins here in Columbus. And you're right. I mean, he's a clutch player. You're right. He's also unfairly maligned for not being a playoff performer. His numbers suggest otherwise. And I didn't think he was having his best game last night. I thought he was good, not his best game. But then he scored the clutch goal to give them their third goal. And you know, he didn't have a whole lot of space. You know, he had a blue jacket draped all over him, and he had just enough. And he doesn't need a lot of space to get off that wicked shot, and went right past Bobrovsky. It was great. He had another chance on a breakaway. There were some moments where I was like, ooh, Alex, keep your feet moving. Let's get a little going here. But you know what? At the end of the day, a goal, an assist, and a guarantee that he was able to make sure happened. Not a bad night for number 8.
There are still 3 games left in this series, and if Ovi gets quiet again and the Capitals get eliminated, then the detractors will be able to come out with their pitchforks. But right now, they'll be silent for a little while. He's been fantastic. They got nothing to say. 2 goals in game 2, multi-points in games 3 and 4, both wins. Huge goal to get the Caps over the top when they couldn't step on a throat. He's the one that delivered that skate blade to the neck last night. Nothing negative you could say about this guy right now.
Agreed. And it's remarkable because a few years ago, we're going, well, the new normal is 32 goals and a useful player, but no longer the guy that you can build the roster around. And it's frustrating in the sense that he is still, to in some degree, even as good as he is, he's the best at what he is, and he's one of the best ever at what he is. But there's still some dependency there, if that makes sense. It's like a receiver that has a bad quarterback situation. How much do you blame Demaryius Thomas's lack of production on the fact that maybe his skill set's declining, and the other fact that it's Trevor Siemian and some other hot garbage tire fire trying to throw him the football when they can't? You don't know. Ovechkin's kind of the same way. In the amount of times that, you know, he's going to create 1-on-3 and do some Peter Forsberg or, kind of Kuznetsov-type creativity, that's not him. He's a shooter, a sniper. He needs to be set up an awful lot. And sometimes that's going to dry up. Again, you go back to various series where, as they've lost 3 straight games, he's been pointless and has been a negative. You could point to some of those things, I think, incorrectly, if you just want to take a 30,000-foot view and go, no points for Ovechkin, they lost, bum, choke artist, whatever you want to call it. I always think that's wrong, and there's always a more nuanced approach. But what you can say is, you'd like them, with this great of a player, to have found the right recipe to get past this certain point, and they haven't yet. I think that's fair to say, necessarily. I think you've needed some ingredient. I don't know what it is. I'm not smart enough to know. I don't think they are either, by the way. Otherwise, they would have done it 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 years ago, to be honest with you. But they haven't found the right ingredient with him as their best player to get past that certain point.
Tonight, Max Scherzer, Clayton Kershaw, Nationals, Dodgers. 2 best pitchers in the NL. 2 guys that win the Cy Young Award over the last handful of years every year in that circuit. Scherzer's probably moved past Kershaw as the best pitcher in the game. They'll go toe-to-toe tonight. We'll debate that next. Look ahead to the Nationals as they had a day off yesterday trying to stay warm after taking 2 of 3 from the Mets.
Worried about letting someone else pick out the perfect avocado for your perfect impress them on the third date guacamole? Well, good thing Instacart shoppers are as picky as you are. They find ripe avocados like it's their guac on the line. They are milk expiration date detectives. They bag eggs like the 12 precious pieces of cargo they are. So let Instacart shoppers overthink your groceries so that you can overthink what you'll wear on that third date. Download the Instacart app to get free delivery on your first 3 orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
Welcome back, Grant and Danny. 106.7 The Fan. Late night Nats tonight. You know, I love this. A couple people tweeted me this morning, said, hey, you get some 10 p.m. baseball.
The worst.
I live for it. I lead the league in it. It's my favorite thing. 1 a.m. or so, laying there in bed, watching the ninth inning. Go win a baseball game. Make me feel even better about it. Nats, Dodgers, Chavez Ravine in L.A. By the way, coming up at 12:45, Dane Brugler is going to join us. We'll talk NFL draft with him. Looking forward to hearing what he thinks is going to happen in the top five. Who are the Browns going to take at one? And who's going to be left for the Redskins at 13 in 6 days when they make that much-anticipated first-round pick? But let's get into the Nats game tonight. So you got Kershaw, who won the Cy Young Award in 2013 and 2014. He actually won the award or was the runner-up in four straight seasons from 2011 to 2014. He finished third or better in balloting every year before 2016 when he finished fifth that year. He missed 11 starts because of injury, or he would have won the award. He had an ERA in the ones. So this is the best pitcher in baseball since 2011. He's a Hall of Famer. This is arguably, and I'm not overstating this, the greatest player in sports of my lifetime at his sport. Like him at pitching, LeBron James in basketball are comparable. But right now, as he's 30 and has overcome injuries now where he hasn't gotten through a full season in three of the last 4 years, Max Scherzer has caught him. Scherzer's won the last two Cy Youngs. Last season, if Kershaw was fully healthy for the duration of the year, he probably would have won the Cy Young Award over Scherzer. He had more wins, which writers care about. I don't. He had a better ERA, better ERA plus, strikeouts per walks a little bit better. Now, Kershaw's case was pretty well made as well. He led the league in, among other categories, strikeouts, whip, lowest hits per nine rate, and he ended up winning it going away because he was durable and Kershaw wasn't. But they're both on the mound tonight. This is your best pitching matchup of the season. It literally cannot get any better than this. It's the number one and the number two guy in all of baseball, however you rank them. So far this year, Kershaw's got a 1.73 through four starts. Scherzer's got a 1.33 through four starts. Max is 3-1 to begin the year. Last year at Dodger Stadium, Danny, he struck out 14 in a 2-1 win. Kershaw, last time we saw him in the seventh inning, took a shutout into the frame, fanned the side. He ended up striking out 12 batters with no walks. So he's coming off his best young start of the season. But, man, is this going to be fun.
It's a tremendous matchup, and these are the kinds you dream about. Somehow, if there was a third team involved and Corey Kluber could throw, that would be really cool, too. But these are the two guys that are your studs, your horses. If you're going to rank these two guys, you've got to go way down the line of statistics. So if you hear me say something in the next several seconds that's nitpicky about one, just know that you've got to really be desperate to find it if you're comparing who the best in the world is. So I would say this. If everybody is healthy and makes their 30-plus starts, Clayton Kershaw's still the one seed to me. And that's no knock against Max Scherzer, who has made those 30 starts. He's been excellent. In fact, each of his last 2 years, a total of 65 starts to 48. Hence, the two Cy Youngs for Max Scherzer over Clayton Kershaw. So then you start to go into strikeout rate, innings pitched, hard contact percentage. Over the course of these years, since just at the time that Scherzer's been in the National League, and Kershaw has obviously always been in the National League, but Scherzer's given up way more homers than Clayton Kershaw. Now, Scherzer's batting average against is right there comparable, has been better. For example, he was better last year than Kershaw was, but generally, your hard hit percentage, your amount of square-up contact, the metrics are going to be tilted towards Clayton Kershaw. But right now, you can count on Scherzer every fifth day, even with that neck thing that he had last year, still made 31 starts, and Kershaw's fallen short there since he threw 232 innings in 2015.
Which is a big part of it.
It's a massive part of it.
I think plenty of people in baseball, and I said last week for the first time, I believe Scherzer has become the guy in the sport. Last year, Kershaw gave you 175 innings, Max gave you 200. The year before that, Kershaw gave you 149, Max gave you 228
yep.
to lead Major League Baseball that year. Kershaw has not been a durable, every fifth day, go deep into starts guy other than two times in the last five, six seasons. He led the sport in innings in 2015. Not surprisingly, that year he was one of the best pitchers in the game with an ERA of 2.13. Somehow, by the way, he didn't win the Cy Young Award in 2015, which is just an utter joke. Jake Arrieta won it that year in his career year, and Zach Greinke, believe it or not, finished ahead of him as well. But I think over the last two seasons, you've got to give Kershaw second place. And
agreed.
Scherzer the not,
agreed,
who obviously won the Cy Youngs just because of the health. Now, you said your caveat was if they're both healthy, dot, dot, dot.
Yes.
I'm just dealing with the reality right now, this moment of the rest of this season, who would I rather have? And my answer for the first time in my life with post-2008 Clayton Kershaw in the major leagues is Max Scherzer.
It's Scherzer.
It's Scherzer. These guys broke in, by the way, the exact same year. Kershaw was 20. Max was 23. Now, he's older. So I'll take over the next 4 years, obviously, Clayton Kershaw, who's 30 instead of 33. But they came in together the same year back in 08. Just so happened Scherzer was 23 and Kershaw wasn't old enough to drink.
I mean, the numbers on Kershaw, as you said, Hall of Fame stuff, it's staggering.
Oh, he's a first ballot, like universally voted in type guy.
Since his rookie year, has not had an ERA that exceeded 2.91.
What's his career earned run average? Let me guess.
Guess it. Because it's a stupid number.
I've looked it up before, and I got nothing in front of me. I think it's something insane like 2.3.
2.35.
Does anyone understand how stupid that is?
That's an insane number. Now, he pitches in a great place to pitch with some good teams.
Not 35 times a year.
Not 35. I mean, good gravy. Those numbers are staggering. Now, Max Scherzer's career ERA, still very good.
I would guess, and this is, I haven't looked this up in a long time. I would guess it's in the threes, I would say, because he pitched in the American League. I would say it's like 3.1.
3.27. That's because he has two really odd years. That one,
the Arizona year?
No, the one year in Detroit where he had a 4.43, inexplicably.
What year was that?
That was 2011. He was 15-9, was pretty good, just had a funky, weird year that you can't figure out. I don't know what the hell happened.
Had he been great before that and then stepped back, or was that before he became Max Scherzer?
His first year in Detroit, he had a 3.5 and was very good. His third year in Detroit had a 3.7, and again, it was very good. That was in that when that division was just a buzzsaw offensively.
But he basically, I don't want to say reinvented himself. He became a lot better at the end of his time in Detroit. If
2013.
You look at Arizona, yes, and then early Tigers Max Scherzer, unlike Clayton Kershaw, he was not a superstar. It wasn't that he wasn't a good prospect. He was a top-of-the-board pick. Kershaw, believe it or not, was picked, I think, sixth overall out of a Dallas high school, which is crazy that there were five guys taken before him, mm-hmm, as good as he was at 20 years old. But I think with Scherzer, I don't know what it was. That's actually something I don't know that we've ever asked him, and it would be interesting to talk to him about.
We talked to him about it a bit.
He's basically had two careers. It's everything before he became the ace, front of the rotation, all-star game starting type pitcher, and now he keeps getting better with this big contract.
So he came in, if you remember, and I'm sure you do because you're a Johnny Prospect over there, but he came in this hard thrower that was upper 90s, and it was, you know, trying to blow everybody away, and it was stuff, stuff, stuff. And sometimes he'd have great starts, and sometimes he'd have terrible starts. It was very, you know, I don't know, late career Nolan Ryan-esque, where he was in danger of throwing a no-hitter, but also could give up 7, 8, 9 runs. And
Mike Rizzo was the one that found him and brought him to AZ.
Absolutely. So then once he finally lived up to his promise that second to last year in Detroit in 2013, when it all kind of came together, struck out an outrageous number of batters, 240 and 214 innings. The click happened where he was able to master all three of those pitches, pitched to more control. It was 2.9.
And so he dropped under 3.
Yeah.
And he basically was all world strikeouts.
And that 2.9 sound, it was obviously great, but like last year, Gio Gonzalez was like a 2.9.
So, yeah, but the American League sub-3 is a big difference.
That American League division in those couple years was, as I said, a buzzsaw. Pitching in the AL, different animal. Followed that up with a 3.15. First getting to the National League, pitching for the Nationals, he's gotten better every single campaign, coming off back-to-back Cy Youngs. It's a fun comparison because you're basically, if you write down the wrong name, you still have one of the best of all time. You still got a guy that's a juggernaut at his position.
I say this all the time. If I'm a pitcher in Major League Baseball and I'm a free agent, you'd better pay me so much more to bring me to the AL than for me just to go to the National League. Most of these guys want to hit anyway, by the way.
Mm-hmm.
It's not like they want to avoid hitting because you could say, oh, then they've got to deal with laying bunts down and hitting. I don't really talk to pitchers that often, I don't know about you, that don't enjoy getting to get into the batter's box. They all think they're better at it than they
are,
typically. Why does anyone sign with an American League team at the same money they can make to go to the National League? It's almost a guaranteed Craig Lachlan that your ERA goes down. It is a Yaroslav Halak that your strikeout rate goes up. It is a Courtney Lachlan that your numbers, just by being the exact same guy, all make people think you're better than you have been. Why don't people just crowbar their way into the National League? I'll never understand that.
It's not a bad point by you. I would certainly look to do it. Now, if you just want a certain lifestyle, you want a certain thing, and the opportunities are there, and it's only in American League City, I could live with that. But think about someone like Roger Clemens, pretty much pitched his entire career in the American League East and put up the numbers that he did.
Right.
Staggering, right?
What would that guy have done in the National
League? He got to face the Marlins a couple times
a year. I will say, at the very end of his career, I believe he won a Cy Young when he was like 40-something, if you remember.
Sounds right.
He was either with the Astros or the Marlins at the end of his career. And the Astros at that time were in the National League still. And that's an example of basically a guy benefiting. It was probably back, I would say, in the early 2000s. And I remember winning a Cy Young, and he had just a ridiculous season, and he was over 40 years old.
Yeah, it was a 41-year-old Roger Clemens, great pull, in 2004 with Houston.
And that was the NL Houston.
That was the National League Houston.
And you're thinking, what if this guy was in that league?
What if he just got to do it?
All along.
And what if he never got fat? Seriously, what if he never got fat
really
in Boston?
Funny.
And then decided to do everything that he did to transform himself?
Dane Brugler next. We'll talk about some small guys, some fat guys, all kinds of different players. NFL draft 6 days away. Grant and Danny, 106.7 The Fan. We are officially elbow deep into draft week. We are 6 days away from the start of the NFL draft. Dane Brugler is an NFL draft analyst for NFL Draft Scout. He joins us right now on the Mattress Warehouse Hotline. Dane, great having you back on the show. We've missed you, man. You always do a very good job. Let's start right at the top of the board with the Browns. Darnold or Allen, who do they take to get this thing going? And then after that, when does the draft really officially begin?
Well, I'm embarrassed to say how many mock drafts I've done up to this point, but in every single one, I've done Sam Darnold at number one to the Browns, and I'm not going to change it at this point. I still believe Sam Darnold is the top quarterback in this draft. I think he fits a lot of what John Dorsey looks for. I understand that the Josh Allen argument, the AFC North is the only division in the NFL where all four teams are cold weather outdoor cities. You know, so I think it's definitely possible that they would go in that direction, choosing the bigger guy, bigger hands, fitting that Ben Roethlisberger mold, played in Wyoming, played in the snow, all that. I get it. But I think at the end of the day, they go with the best quarterback, and that's Sam Darnold. But I think John Dorsey's keeping this close to the vest. I don't think he's telling Hugh Jackson who they're taking. I don't think he's telling much of the people in that building. So I think we're going to be left. It's going to be a lot of suspense leading up to Thursday night. And then it starts at number two. That's where a lot of the intrigue is. What do the Giants do? Running back Saquon Barkley is certainly in the mix. They could trade out. Do they go with a quarterback? Eli Manning, 37 years old. Are they really going to pass on possibly the future of that position? And then we know how much they desire pass rush and how Bradley Chubb is in that mix. So will there be a team that offers enough? The Buffalo Bills. The team that sticks out the most because they have two first round picks, multiple picks on day two. Will they package enough of those picks, have enough ammo to entice the Giants to get out of the top 10 altogether back to 12 for the Bills to go up and get their quarterback? It's really going to be fascinating with the first two picks, what those teams do.
Dan, how many blue chip guys are there? And I guess what I mean is you say, hey, I got a first round grade on somebody and you know, the pick at 27 is going to be different than the pick at say 9 or 10. How many difference-making franchise-type building blocks are there in this first round as opposed to guys that will just go help some teams? Where's that cutoff in your mind?
Yeah, and obviously the answer will be different depending on who you ask. But I think it's not include the quarterbacks because, you know, quarterbacks obviously are held to a different standard. I mean, an average, a B-level quarterback in the NFL is worth, a top three pick. So not including any of the quarterbacks, I think this draft has six, seven names. When on offense, you have Quentin Nelson, who in my mind is the top player in the draft out of Notre Dame, the offensive guard. I'm not saying he should go number one overall, but he is the best football player in this draft. Saquon Barkley, the running back out of Penn State, also in that mix. And then I think the rest of the guys are on defense in the secondary. Minkah Fitzpatrick, Denzel Ward, Derwin James. I think all three of those belong in that top tier of prospects. And then I think Roquan Smith from Georgia, the outstanding linebacker, and then Bradley Chubb, the pass rusher. I would keep it to those six or seven names if we're talking about the best of the best that this draft class has to offer.
there's a math equation playing out for the Redskins here that we've got to delve into with Dane Brugler, and that is the question as to which defensive player is going to fall into their lap. I mean, how many quarterbacks go in the top 12 directly affects them, because now let's say six do, there's only six potential defensive players off the board. Barkley's definitely going, now there's five. Nelson's definitely going, now there's four. They want, let's say, Vita Vea or Tremaine Edmonds or Roquan Smith or Derwin James. It seems like there's a really good chance one of those guys has to be available for them, right?
Yeah, I think so. And I think I'd include Minka Fitzpatrick in that group, a player who I think some teams are just kind of worried about where to play him. Is he a true corner? Is he a true safety? Is he specifically just that nickel player? To me, I think he can do it all, and I think he can do it all at a high level. So I think Minka Fitzpatrick, what happened last year with the Redskins, they stayed put, and a really good Alabama defensive prospect fell to them. This could happen again this year with Minka Fitzpatrick. Stay put at 13, and a really good Alabama defensive player could end up falling to them. So I think Minka's in that mix. Vita Vea out of Washington, you know, it's kind of a tough discussion, because I think what he offers is the ability to clog up run lanes, keep blockers occupied, really helping out. You know, the ripple effect that Vita Vea provides is going to help the entire front seven, the entire defense. And so there's a strong argument to be made with him. I think, you know, some teams are a little down on him because he doesn't offer pass rush value. There's some questions about him being an every down player, but if he can do, you know, his strength as a player, just the wide body, the power at the point of attack, and his ability to get off blocks, so he's impacting what's going on in the trenches. If he can do that at high level, even if it's only for two downs, then it's still going to be rated highly. So I think he's in that mix.
You don't think he'll be able to rush the quarterback a little bit?
Maybe a little bit, but he didn't do it consistently at Washington. You know, I mean, he had six sacks, I think, in his career at Washington. Mm-hmm. He was a guy that, you know, you could see it in flashes, but you didn't see it down in, down out. Because first of all, I'm not sure how much he was asked to do so, but I think his strength is going to be to take on blocks. You know, he's going to be asked to two gap. He's going to be asked to do all those things that more of a traditional nose tackle is asked to do. Now, I do think he'll have his time where he'll be able to split double teams and squirt through gaps and affect what's going on in the pocket. But I think if you're drafting him, especially for a team like the Redskins and what they do on defense, it'll be a more traditional nose. You know, he has experience as more of a five or even lining up outside the tackle. So I think he can do it, but I think he's going to be looked at as more of a nose player.
Last minute here with Dane Brugler, senior NFL draft analyst for NFLDraftScout.com on the Mattress Warehouse hotline. Dane, one name I want to ask you about, Daron Payne specifically. Give me your eval there. That's somebody that's also been kicked around for the Redskins. And then who's a guy that you like more than the industry does?
Yeah, Daron Payne, I think he's not too far off from Vita Vea in terms of the, you know, the bigger one technique, the nose tackle defensive players in this draft. Daron Payne's a really good player. He tested really well, too. 6'2 and a half, 310 pounds, ran a 4.9 in the 40-yard dash. The thing is with Daron Payne is, which player am I getting? Am I getting the player we saw in the playoffs against Clemson and against Georgia, where he was just absolutely dominant? He looked like Ndamukong Suh out there. Or am I getting the guy that, you know, we saw for most of his career, where you see the traits, but you don't necessarily see the production. You don't see him impacting enough plays. And I think part of that is what he was asked to do in Nick Saban's scheme. You know, traditionally we see, you know, it happened with Jonathan Allen. It helped, or happened with A'shaun Robinson. A lot of the defensive linemen that have come before Daron Payne, where they're just asked to hold the point of attack. They're asked to, clog up the different run lanes so they can not only stop the run, but free up passing lanes for the linebackers to get through and get after the quarterback. So I think that's part of the evaluation. Payne's a young player. He's going to be 20 years old on draft weekend. There's a lot to like about him. So I think if he could go somewhere in the top 20, might fall to the top 25, but he's right there in that mix. A player that I'm higher on than most, I think go to the wide receiver position, DJ Moore out of Maryland. I've been high on him since October, when a scout kind of tipped me off that he was leaning towards going pro as a junior. Really fascinating what he did at Maryland, where they went through eight quarterbacks the last few years. He caught a pass from all eight of them. Really athletic. He can create before and after the catch.
I know the Steve Smith comparisons get a little overblown with smaller receivers who are competitive and tough, but I don't know how you can't watch DJ Moore and get those Steve Smith vibes from what he does on the football field. I believe a top 20 pick in this draft, and I think he has a chance to go there. I wouldn't be surprised if he's the top receiver on the Cowboys draft board.
Dane, I've been enjoying your draft content for months, and we've been having you on the show for a couple of years now. Thanks so much. Really appreciate it. It's almost that time again.
Anytime. Thanks, guys.
Thank you, buddy.
6 days away from the start of the NFL draft. There's Dane Brugler. Next, Wizards, Raptors, game 3 tonight, 8 o'clock, Capital One Arena. Chris Miles, what's going to happen? 2-1 series, or are the Wizards looking at a potential sweep? We'll find out.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.